The Guardian.
Adrian Holofoti has something of a cult following among technologically inclined journalists. He's a rare combination of a trained journalist and computer programmer. And it's not so much that what he describes is so radical, it's more that he highlights a few ingrained cultural prejudices and perhaps a little short-sightedness that have stopped news organisations exploring the potential of data in news. In a session for The Guardian, chaired by Emily Bell, the Director of Digital Content, Adrian Holofoti starts by telling us that journalism is broken and that in practical terms the daily processes of journalists are inefficient, wasting much of the powerful raw data at the root of the stories they write.
Thanks very much for coming, everyone. I'm going to talk about some concepts of combining two disciplines that you don't really see combined very often, and that's journalism and computer programming, computer science. I think it's a tragedy that we don't combine these disciplines as much as we should. And I'm going to give you some reasoning why we should do this more often and some examples of what interesting things can happen if you do combine journalism and computer programming. So I'll start off with a bit of a statement. Can everyone see that? It's a little...
There might be a way of lowering the lights. There's a kind of a... this thing. If I play around with that.
Okay. So, I think that journalism is broken. And these days, you can give a lot of explanations for why journalism is broken. You can look at newspaper circulation, which has been going down since at least the 70s. You can look at stock prices of publicly traded newspaper companies. This is the Washington Post since the beginning of this year. It's been going down. It's personally disappointing for me because it's the only company whose stock I own. Then there is all, of course, broken media bias in terms of Republican Party influencing the media and all sorts of bias that's not so good. So all of those ways that journalism is broken are outside of the scope of this talk. What I want to talk about is a much more fundamental way that I think journalism is broken, and I'll address how we can unbreak it. And that is that journalists collect all of this information from the world every day, but they throw it out. And the distinction there of what they're throwing out is very subtle, so I'll explain this. Now, take a look at a very cliche yet stupidly simple example of what a journalist does every day. So say this is a police station reporter, a crime reporter, and he goes to the police station every day and he says, "What's the latest?" And the head policeman says, "Well, there was a burglary today. It happened at 123 Main Street, which is the house of John Smith. They stole $500, and including an iPod and a laptop, and we think that it happened sometime between 10 and 11. In the morning. And what does the journalist do? The journalist is writing all of this down. And if you looked at that notebook, what would it say? It would say, the type of the crime is a burglary, the address is this, the loot is this, and time is this, and the victim was John Smith. And then, of course, the reporter goes back to the newsroom and comes up with something that looks like this. John Smith's house, 123 Main Street, was burglarized, blah, 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 blah. Now, this is a very subtle thing, but this thing that we're looking at is the root of the tragedy. Now, when you look at this, what is this fundamentally? Of course, it's a newspaper article, but more conceptually, what is this? It is a bunch of beautiful, clean data. So the type of the crime is this, the address is this, this is this, this equals this, compressed into a blob. And that is kind of not so nice. Now, what do I mean by this? If you look at this, this is the same data. There's nothing in here that doesn't appear in there. It's just massaged in a way so that humans can understand it, right? So you wouldn't want to just give humans that. The whole purpose of journalism, or one of the purposes of journalism, is to explain the world in a very easy to consume narrative, right? So this has the same data as that, it's just oriented toward humans. Now the problem with that is it's not oriented toward computers, and I think we ought to be doing both. So if you look at the same data in an Excel spreadsheet, this is what we call structured data, right? So because someone has taken the time of inserting this piece of data in this field and this, then a computer can very easily say, or I can tell a computer, show me all the murders. It's very easy to do in Excel. You could just say, search for murder in that particular field and hide all the rest of it. Now, with a newspaper article, a computer can't do that because it's unstructured information. And unstructured information is hard for computers to deal with, and that is part of the tragedy. So I'll give you an example of that. If you go to Google, the state of the art in finding information, and you want to ask it, what are the crimes in my neighborhood? How would you do that? You would say probably 123 Main Street crime, assuming you live at 123 Main Street, but that doesn't answer your question. That just happens to be the set of documents that contains that text. And that's really the best that Google can do, because Google isn't dealing with the raw data. Google is dealing with the articles, the blobs, and that's the best it can do. These articles happen to contain that text. Now, same thing with if you want to research a subtle topic like Boris Johnson's opinion on crime data. How would you do that on Google? Type in crime data, Boris Johnson opinion. But again, that only gives you the documents that contain that text. It's because Google's not dealing with that structured data. So it's interesting because on the other end of things, in the computer science world, people are obsessed with trying to extract the structure from the blobs. This is an academic paper, automatic extraction of opinion propositions and their holders. And it's a methodology for, given a newspaper article, see if we can automatically detect this person and his opinion on something based on his quote. And then there's another academic paper, automatic paraphrase acquisition from news articles. Let's see if we can get a computer to automatically take a 500-word article and make a one-paragraph summary. They're coming at it from this other end, but why do they need to do that? Journalists already have people. They have a machinery and an infrastructure and workforce devoted to dealing with this information. Why do we need this sort of stuff? The two need to meet in the middle. So the tragedy outlined for you is that news organizations have the infrastructure to go out into the world and collect information. Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, none of these other companies have the infrastructure of going out into the world and sending people to political events and sporting events and school events. No, Google is never going to hire people to go to schools and report on how the teachers are doing. No other industry has this. This is something that we as journalists have a monopoly on, and it's great, and it's an advantage. We have the infrastructure to edit that and verify it, which is hugely important. And then finally, we have the infrastructure to get that information out to people. In the old days, this meant that we owned printing presses or cable TV stations. Now it means that we have brands that people know to come to, because anyone can publish online, but people know to go to The Guardian for trusted news, trusted information. So we have all of those three things, which are huge advantages, but we haven't actually taken advantage of that data that we're collecting. So that's why we're seeing the computer scientists and the Googles of the world saying, oh, let's see if we can automatically extract that. they're at such a disadvantage because we are the ones who own the data. We ought to be taking more advantage of it. The goal, as I see it, is to take that, remember this article, that blob that I showed you, and turn it into something a little more like this, where John Smith's house, 123 Main Street, you can click 123 Main Street and see all the other stuff that's been reported around there. Was burglarized. You can click burglarized and see all the other burglaries. Between 11 or 10 and 11, click that and see all the other news that happened in that time. An iPod was stolen. Click iPod, see all the other coverage of iPods that have been stolen. Journalists have all of this information implicitly because we're out there with that infrastructure collecting the data from the world, but we're not taking advantage of it, and we can't automatically do that. A laptop was stolen. I'm interested in this. Show me everything else. There's this concept of serendipity, right, that I would argue people are expecting these days. You look at something like Wikipedia, article on Sydney. Probably, 15 or 20% of the text here is linked. Because you never know, as a web content creator, what people are interested in. I was visiting Sydney last year, and I was reading this, and I read about Sydney has some world-famous beaches. Oh, I clicked world-famous beaches and saw a list of them, and then clicked another one, and then found out about this concept of shark nets, which I'd never heard of, these gigantic nets that capture sharks so they don't eat people. And I had never known about this, and sort of more abstractly, I didn't even know that I wanted to know about that. But I learned it because I clicked on something. Now, if our news articles were more like this, it would enable more of that, and it would match people's expectations of that. Also, look at something like IMDb, where any discrete piece of information is clickable. This is a particular movie was directed by this person. I can click his name to see all the other films that person directed. I can click 1980 to see all the other films from that year. Because this is structured information, and journalists ought to be adapting that. Same with Amazon, right? Click an artist or an author and see all the other stuff for sale by that person. Structured data in action. So why haven't we done this yet? I think it's instructive to look at, to answer this question in order to have a solution, we have to look at what the problems are. One is, journalists aren't the best people at technology. I graduated from journalism school, and probably about five times across my 4 years of study, a journalism professor would say, "Oh, but that would require statistics and knowing math, and that's why we went to journalism school, because we wouldn't have to take math classes," and everyone would laugh, except me. I was like, this is like some blatant anti-intellectualism, right? Why don't journalists care more about this? There's this arrogance also that computers, you know, they're evil and it's all a yes or no thing and they don't know shades of gray and you can't make a database of the world. That's why we need words and narrative to explain the world. You can't database everything. But I'll show you in a little bit how that's a misconception. And finally, there's a problem with our tools. At probably every newspaper whose content management system I've seen, it's something like this. And if you're not familiar with content management systems, it's the system that you use to publish information to the web. It asks, say you want to publish a story. It asks you to input the headline, input the date, input the byline, and then paste in the story. Now, this is an invitation to make a blob, because that's just a big box, and you don't have any room to add any sort of additional information, like, yeah, it's about an iPod. Tell the computer that it's about iPods and stolen iPods. Tell the computer that it's about this particular topic, so then the computer can automatically make that association. No, because all you get is this big box, and that's why we have the blobs. It's a huge problem. So we have to go to our vendors and demand that they get rid of this. I'm not saying abolish the article. I'm saying add more information, because it takes only about 10 seconds for a human to say, oh yeah, this is about this and this and this and this. And then with that 10 seconds of effort, you can start to do all sorts of interesting automated things. So I'll give you an example. I recently worked at the Washington Post, and a huge story for us, very obviously, was the Iraq War, and particularly the sub-story of how many casualties there have been. And the traditional way of covering this story was the anniversary story, or the milestone story, rather. So U.S. toll in Iraq crosses 1,000 milestone. A couple months later, military has lost 2,000. A couple months later, the U.S. toll reaches 3,000. So we're writing stories about these people. We write obituaries. And there is all sorts of structure there, but we're not taking advantage of it. And I found out that indeed the reporters were keeping a little database of every casualty. Why? Not so they could publish it, so that they would know definitively, we have 2,999. That means we have to write a 3,000 anniversary story tomorrow in case there's a casualty. Well, if you have that data, why don't you open it up and make let people browse it? Take advantage of that structure. So we made this site called Faces of the Fallen, which is updated every day or whenever there's new casualties, and lists every casualty and all the information we have about them. This is the main page. Every person gets his or her own page with a map of the hometown. All the information we have about them, we might link to family tribute sites or any additional coverage. If we had the entire article, we'd paste it in there. But the thing is, you can click on any one of those things and continue to explore the data, just like that blob that I showed where I want to be able to click iPod, I want to be able to click the address. So I can view by age. And this makes some really arresting visuals. So this is casualties by age. In case you can't see, that's 21-year-olds who have the highest, and then it slopes off. And then, interestingly, around 36, it goes back up again. This was a catalyst for further reporting. Why does that show up in the data? You can click on any one of those and see a list of all the people that are that age. You can view a map of the country, see how many casualties by state, view all the casualties for a particular state, see where they're geographically distributed, and get notifications whenever someone from your state is added to the list. This sounds really grotesque and morbid and sad, but people actually use this. Activists use these feeds and put them on their websites. Just normal citizens want to keep track of this stuff. So I showed you earlier that publishing system and how it only allowed for a big blob. How we pulled this Faces of the Fallen site off is we went beyond this. We started capturing structured information. This is what it looks like. For every casualty, you add the person's title, the first name, the last name, the military branch, how old he or she was, the home city, and a bunch of other stuff that I couldn't fit on here. So because we're taking advantage of that very structured database, that lets us make this site completely automatically. The only human input is this. The rest of this, all that I showed you, is completely automated. So when there's a new casualty, we don't have to say, oh, let's update the Texas page because he was from there, and let's update the 23-year-old's page and that page and this page. It's all completely automated out of the database. So the goal here is to find the line between what computers are good at and what humans are good at and push it as close to the automation as possible. So the entire production of the site is automated. What humans are really good at is researching, contacting the government, making sure it's not BS, contacting the families to verify, interviewing people, cross-checking the information. That's what they're good at. And then they put it in here and the computer does the rest of it. Another example, slightly less depressing, is video game reviews. the traditional way that we published this information on the Washington Post site was just this list of headlines. And you click an article and you read it, and that's it. Now, there's shared structure in every video game review. Every review has the platform that it's about, or the game system, what the game is rated, how much it costs, when it was released, the manufacturer of the game. If I only own a Nintendo Wii, I don't want to see this thing and have to manually look at it and manually parse it for the only thing that I care about, which is the Wii. So give me an opportunity to just sort for the Wii or the PlayStation or whatever else. So we let you view by price, we let you view by the game manufacturer, which some people are really into for whatever reason. Let you view by the rating, and then finally every game gets its own page which lists all the attributes and then lets you click into the database. So this was rated M for mature. Parents, hide your children. But click that and then see all the other games with that rating. So it's that serendipity. It's that being of the web instead of on the web. Another example, when I worked in this tiny paper in Lawrence, Kansas, we made an entertainment site. And we wanted to do something with local restaurant information. There is a ton of structure there. There's all sorts of common attributes. So this was a restaurant review, and you notice that in the review, always toward the end of the story, they say this restaurant is open whenever they're open, right? So some human has done that effort, which is the hardest part. Some human has already made that effort of getting the information, verifying it, and editing it. But all it did was appear at the end of that story, right? And we didn't do anything with it. Well, instead of settling for that, we made a database of this and just added some structure to this. And that lets us do something like this, where there's a page on the site where you view it and it shows you which restaurants are open right now as of when you're looking at the page. This is something that obviously never would have been possible without that structure, because I guess the only thing you could have done otherwise was read every single restaurant review, look for the hours, and is it open now? Yes or no? You know, ludicrous. So because we added that structure, and again, the hard part is getting the information that was already being retrieved, it was already being edited. People already type it into a computer at some point. You should make it so that when the data enters the computer, it's put into a format that a computer can do interesting things with. So that's the core lesson. Another example, at this same website, lawrence.com, we covered local music scene. There's a huge local music scene, relatively speaking, in Lawrence. And of course, every article about a band had the band features this guy on guitar and that person on keyboard and this person on that instrument. That's just what the reporter does. It's like the first question you ask a band when you're doing a story, right? Well, we figured out there's some structure there too. So let's make it a database. We made a page for every band and then we list all the musicians. Of course, that's and the obvious thing to do, but the interesting thing is you can click on a musician, see all the other bands he or she is in, click an instrument, see all the other people in town that play that instrument. The local musicians loved this because it's like their little networking thing, right? Oh, wow, I didn't know this other guy played pedal steel. It's such a rare thing to find someone who plays that. So I keep stressing this point. We were already collecting that information. The reporter was already on the phone with the lead singer and getting that, oh, you have someone who plays pedal steel. We just need to put it into a database so that computers can do interesting things with it. This is an example of a site made by the St. Petersburg Times newspaper, and it's called politifact.com. Now, this is an example of something where they wanted to do a project like this with structured information, and it's an example of information that they weren't already collecting, but they wanted to experiment with databasing information. What this is calling BS on politicians. So they take statements that have been made in the media and they actually research it to see if it's true or if it's false, and then they structure it. So, for example, here are recent statements made by Barack Obama. They list the statement, when it was made, where it was made, and you can read more. And then mostly true, true, false, mostly true. So you can view all the things that John McCain has said. This is my favorite thing about the site. True, mostly true, half true, rarely true, false, pants on fire. I just had to give you a screenshot of that. This is a pants on fire one. Obama suggested bombing Pakistan. So this, what is this? This is finding structure in an area where it doesn't seem like a yes or no thing, right? Like, you don't think, oh yeah, politicians and what they talk about. Let's make a database. So this goes to show that there are ways that you can find structure in the world at large. Another interesting page from this is attacks. They classify a certain statement as an attack as opposed to just a normal statement. And then they, of course, because they put in a database and labeled them and given them a date, they can automatically generate a list of the most recent ones. So Fidel Castro endorses Obama. That one is a pants on fire. And all sorts of other interesting things. Really, really cool site, PolitiFact. You can see statements by issue. They've also manually tagged those. So here's every statement about abortion and whether they're true or false. So finding the structure out there in the world. And I'm happy to talk with you if you have any questions about, I cover such and such. Is there any structure in there? So we can save that for the Q&A. Now, the really interesting thing to me is when we can completely automate the retrieval of information. Every example I've shown you so far has been the reporters already making the calls and doing the research. Let's just shift things 5 degrees and then enter it into a database. Now, the next step, and this can't always work. It's not always possible, but in some cases, you can automatically retrieve information. And that's very good because it's scalable. So there's a one-time cost of setting it up, and then you never have to worry about it again. You don't have to worry about manually doing any sort of labor. It's great. An example of this is a site that I helped make at the Washington Post called the U.S. Congress Votes Database. This is every vote that happened in the U.S. Congress, in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. This is the main page. You can view every vote gets its own page where you can view by political party, by state, by the region of the country, by astrological sign of the member of the House of Representatives. I don't know how I got away with that. Every page, every member of Congress gets his or her own page, and you can see their full voting history. And of course, you can see the late night votes, because this is when the very sketchy stuff tends to happen. So you can see this is every vote that happened between midnight and 7 a.m. They figure journalists aren't paying attention then. Well, if we have every vote in a database and we have the time that it happened, a computer can very easily say, detect all the late night votes. Same thing goes for the page of people who have missed the most votes. This is an interesting one. The problem is this first guy died. But that's also an interesting little side point. Automation can only get you so far, and oftentimes there's a good reason, such as death. But it's not an all or nothing thing. You can combine the automated query with human reporting. And that's indeed what we did. Here we put a little note. Johnson suffered a brain hemorrhage on December 13, 2006 and has not returned to the Senate. So this is, I really wanted to point this out just to say that you can combine things. So what is this? This whole page has come out of a database, but we've explicitly in our database put an area where a journalist, a reporter, can explain why that person is in that position. And as you develop journalism applications, it's really important to be able to have the flexibility to add those sorts of things. Because when we launched with this, we didn't have that. And it just had the guy up top there. Of course, if you automate things, then you can automate feeds. So we have a feed for every member of Congress, and you can get notified whenever they vote. Now, how does this site work? The government in the U.S. has its House of Representatives site, it has its Senate site, then it has its biograph site where you can get all the bios and pictures of everyone. So I had a program that automatically grabbed that site every day, every hour actually, automatically checked this site, and for the biographies and photos, went to that one whenever it found a new member of Congress that it hadn't seen before, which is rare, but it happens. So because all of that data is published already, we were able to completely automate the creation of this site. As soon as a vote was published to that site, we published it. Now, you might ask, well, if it's already being published on the official site, what good does it do for the Washington Post to do it? Well, my answer, I'll go back a couple slides. My answer is this, late night votes. My answer is this, members who have missed the most votes. My answer is this, RSS feeds. Features that they don't support. Views of the data that they don't want to show because they don't want to look bad. And that's what journalism is all about. And then finally, there's a women in the Senate page because the biography page doesn't have the gender. So the computer program has to check this and see if the person's name is on that list. If so, it is a female. If not, it is a male. Complicated. So this guy evidently has been talking about opening up crime data. And that's something that really excites me, and I wanted to show you some experience I've had with crime data. In Chicago, where I live, there's this site called Citizen ICAM, and it is atrocious. So you go there, and you first of all have to click this gigantic disclaimer, and then click the disclaimer again because it's a bug. Then you see this really, really nasty form where you put in your address and put in a date range, and there's some obscure limitations, no later than February 1, no earlier than this. And then it gives you this just god-awful map of all the crimes near you. I can't click on that map. I can't interact with it. This is actually better than some cities because some cities use a skull and crossbones for murders and like a garter or something for prostitution, or a bra. It's just tacky. But I found this site, and I discovered that you can somehow, by looking at the code, get the raw data out. So what I did was I made my own site, chicagocrime.org, that took that data once a day, automatically grabbed everything, and made it so that humans could actually use it. And one big difference here I'll point off right off the bat is that these links invite you to explore. When you go to the page, you don't just see a big form asking you for five different pieces of information. It's a link that you just click, and you're exploring the information. Let me show you a quick run-through of the site. You can view by type of crime. So here's all the mob action. Always a fun example for Chicago. There's crimes by location. Here's every barbershop crime. Here's every library crime. Here's every taxicab crime. It's actually a very safe city. This site scares some people, but you know, if and when London gets open data, you'll see the truth. You can view by address and see all this stuff on that block. You can view by the day, which this split it up by the hour, so you can see when crimes sort of get more in the afternoon and not so much at night. Here's a page that represents every crime in the 7 a.m. hour between 7 and 8 on February 10th of 2006. Here's my favorite thing, which was crimes along a route. So say you go jogging or walk to the train station, you can zoom in on the map and click on the map and draw my route and then say, yeah, I usually go between 5 and 8 p.m. and I'm only interested in street crime. I don't care about things that happen in houses because I'm walking on the street, of course. And then it'll show you the stuff that happened around there. So, how is this journalism? I've presented this to a lot of old school journalist types and have had enough times that I've done that I've come up with a pretty decent answer. If you look at a traditional print newspaper journalist, the way I see it, there are three very broad tasks that that person does. One is to gather information from the world, right? Whether that's interviewing people, analyzing documents, or just living somewhere, gathering information. The second is distilling it, and that is deciding what's important. This big murder happened, we need to write about it, needs to go on the front page, versus someone got pickpocketed, we don't have any room for that story. And then present the information. So that is writing the story or editing the photo or the video or the audio or any of that. So those are the three broad things. Well, the weirdo journalism computer programmer guy does those same things, just in a different way. And let's compare. So the traditional journalist gathers by, as I said, calling sources, researching, distills by deciding what's worth covering, talking to the editor, using editorial judgment. It's what we all train in. And then presents by writing the article, or as I said, editing the video or whatever. Now the geek journalist does the same stuff, just in a different way. Gathers information in that the automated sense, like Chicago Crime, like that Congress Votes database, gathers it by writing queries to fetch data, writing programs that get information from websites or other digital sources. And the distillation happens by deciding which queries to run. That's the process of, we have all these votes, let's make it so that you can see all the late night votes. Let's make it so that you can view all of the members of Congress who have missed the most votes. It's that, in a way, well, it's very much editorial judgment, but it's a one-time decision because it's then automated from then on. And then the presentation is just designing the website. So those are the three things. They just happen in different ways. Of course, it's not an all-or-nothing thing. The world is shades of gray. So sometimes you have the print reporter or a person actually talks to actual humans rather than writing programs, yet the distillation happens on this side, and sometimes there's both an article and an accompanying website. So you can mix and match, of course. I'm always hesitant to use little charts like this because the world isn't that simple, but I wanted to point that out. Now is a good stopping point. Does anyone have questions about any of that, or rants, or any? Yes.
You know, you're saying that the, you know, you need journalistic skills, but obviously you have computer programming skills as well. Are you saying that we should all learn these computer programming skills in order to do this ourselves, or at least have some kind of idea how to do it, which I would assume most of us don't.
I wouldn't advocate that you would need to learn computer programming, just as you wouldn't need to learn the details of how to shoot a perfect photograph or copy edit a story perfectly. I think that programming should be a sub-discipline in the newsroom. So there's the graphics department, the photo department, the programming department. And what you would need to learn is, are you a reporter or editor?
Business editor.
What you would need to learn is not necessarily those programming skills, but you would need to know the right questions to ask, and you would need to know how to work with the programmer, and you would need to know, in a way, what's possible, so that you can say, I know that it's possible to sort votes by whether they happen late at night, and that's all you need to say. Just, programmer, go into your cave and do that. So, does that answer your question?
But it's quite frustrating, though, because really what you want to do, you know, we're all perfectly capable of doing all of this side ourselves, and you sort of feel like what you would like to do is also do that side as well.
There's probably only enough time in the day to do one or the other, you know. Don't let my...
You do both, though, don't you?
I don't write stories anymore. I don't really call people. So, anything else on this section? Yes, in the back.
You can scale this. How many people were at the Washington Post doing this sort of journalism when you were there? And how many people do you need, do you think, to do it effectively?
When I was at the Post, there was only me and one other guy doing this sort of work, Derek Willis. And the two of us made that vote site in a couple of weeks. I made that Faces of the Fallen site. It didn't take very long, a couple of weeks. Number of other projects that I didn't show. It's a couple week thing. And the nice thing about it is, once you do it, it's that one-time cost, and then it runs itself. Now, the hard part is getting the information. So I was never the one who would get information, except in the cases where I would write the programs. But for the Iraq casualties information, that is a lot of work. So we had a news research team which did the work of contacting the families and cross-checking the Department of Defense casualty listings. So that, I don't know how many people it would take. It depends on the project. But the technology, you can get a lot done with only a few people. I think in back you were first.
I just wonder if there are people now being trained in either computer science courses or in journalism courses to do this kind of stuff, because potentially there's a huge market for people there, and are they being trained?
I don't know of any program that does this sort of thing. I don't know of any professional program that does this sort of thing. Well, there is in the States we have NICAR, National Institute for Computer Assisted Reporting, which is a very silly name considering all journalists use computers, but computer-assisted reporting is this discipline of analyzing databases. But the problem there is it's existed since the 80s, and the mentality in that culture is get a bunch of really cool data and write a newspaper story about it, and not actually show, not that the story is bad, but and write a story about it, which is great, but not make the website. So they need to make that next jump just culturally in that community. But no, I don't know of any programs. I think you were next.
Yeah, you talked about the CMS and the tools and the back end, which obviously if you work online is the kind of one of the things that you have to struggle with, not just the client side stuff. When you were in the Post, did you do you feel that kind of by the time you left, they have a sort of a, you know, journalists were working with the right tools online and it was all seamless and great, etc.? Or how do you have to work outside the... So there always seems to me to be a tension between the immediate and the perfect, and the perfect tends to live in the technologists' minds, and the immediate tends to live in the journalists' minds, and that's why kind of some of that is quite different
right.
square. So I just want to always think about that.
That's a really good question. When I was there, every project that I did had its own separate interface for entering the information. And that's because, well, for one thing, that was the only way with the infrastructure that we could do it. But secondly, the publishing system that they use for stories, this thing called Orbit, is just horrendous. It's god-awful. And they spent several million dollars on it, so they can't justify you getting anything else. It's just a bad scene all around. And the same thing happens at all sorts of big organizations. The problem is that it comes back to that previous slide where there was a spot for the headline and the byline and then the big box. That's what it is. And you can't make a site that's specifically tailored for Iraq casualties with that. So I'm a big advocate of one-off databases for these things. You can't make a one-size-fits-all system. In the back, I saw you first. Yeah.
Hi, we've done some of this kind of analysis, some of the big graphics we've done, the way we've done Iraq or Afghanistan this week with the American elections. But often what we do is kind of frozen in time with the paper, because we do it for that, and then, you know, we don't update it all the time. I kind of wonder how you make those kind of resource decisions on whether something's worth pursuing and just updating constantly, or whether it's just been looked at by about five people, and, you know. It's kind of interesting to do, but not actually worthwhile.
Well, it's just you ask yourself the question. It's the same question as, is it worth doing in the first place for print? It's just the next level of the question, is it worth doing every day for the rest of our lives? And some things are, some things aren't. For something like the election, I would see, it would be easier to justify given that there's an end date in sight. For something like the Iraq casualties, that was a big decision because there's no end in sight and it's a lot of information and it takes a lot of effort to verify all that. How we did end up justifying it was they were already doing it anyway. So we know when we have 2,999, we got to write that story. So, it really depends on the project. Yes?
Yeah, how do you probably have different laws, but how do you deal with the issue of data protection? Because the two databases that I've sort of been vaguely involved with, compiling, one of the people had been arrested, but not necessarily charged on terror offences, and the other of police officers against whom corruption charges have been made. On each occasion, the lawyers suggested that we run into problems if people on those databases find out that we as a newspaper have a database where they might feature and they would like to have a look at, and we might not want to show it to them.
I think that the laws are different. And we, in the U.S., the case law says that facts are not copyrightable. The famous cases with the phone book, someone just wholesale copied a phone book and turned it into a database, and it was okay because it's just facts. This person is this number, this person is this number. But what is copyrightable is the presentation. So this person, if it was some arbitrary order of the people, alphabetical order, it wasn't copyrightable because that's common. And also the public records laws in the states are, I think, a little more open from what I've read. So I can't give you any sort of advice just because I don't know the scene here, unfortunately. I think back there in the white, yeah.
I just wondered, you were talking earlier about how in the past, quite often what happens, people assemble these kind of databases for the purpose of writing a story, but then they didn't make the database available, or it's not available in an ongoing way. I wonder whether the other way around, now that you know, where you've built great databases like this, are stories coming out of them? And are journalists then actually exploiting the resource that's there by mining it in imaginative ways and continuously? And have you got any examples of stories that popped out?
Not as much as they should. They should. But yes, in the case of the Post, I did a database that never saw the light of day, but it was about the number of times President Bush, I grabbed every White House transcript and looked at how many times President Bush used this word and that word. And, you know, very silly stuff, but a reporter did end up using that. For the Iraq casualties, probably that chart of by age, I think that might have been a story, but I don't recall. I know we talked about making a story about that, writing a story. But yeah, it does happen. And I would say that by making it web, making a web interface to it, it increases the likelihood that there would be a story, because that means reporters can interact with it much more easily. And if it's just, you know, some guy with it on his computer in some database program, a reporter probably isn't going to, unless the reporter is very motivated, probably isn't going to look at it and try to make sense of it. Is there something else? Yeah.
Sorry.
Sure.
Difficult is it to do those automated, those programs that will automatically update and look for other things? How would you rate the difficulty of that? How long would it take you to do something like that?
If you know what you're doing, it's very short time, 30 minutes. It depends on what you're scraping. Some websites are very easy to scrape. Some deliberately make it harder. Some not deliberately make it harder. They're just incompetent. So it completely depends.
So it's just being able to write that code that will do it for you?
Yes. Yes. There was someone? Yes.
When the report is the basis of the data, but the reporter isn't inputting it, doesn't the report have to be completely formulaic, or it won't hit the boxes that provide the data to the inputter? In other words, if you say somebody turned over a flat rather than somebody burgled a flat, it's not going to have that trigger word.
So
how can the database then become comprehensive?
If you're saying separate terms for the same...
Yes.
Concept.
Unless the report triggers the input of more data, it seems to be that unless the reports are completely formulaic, it won't hit those buttons.
Right.
To trigger the data.
That's a data cleaning issue, and that's a lot of that organization I mentioned in the States, NICAR. That's a lot of what they teach is if you get a database of crimes from the police department, oftentimes they're entered by humans who make mistakes in addresses, and it might be there are about 50 different spellings of Milwaukee Avenue that I've encountered. So I keep my database of misspellings of Milwaukee Avenue. But yeah, you do have to clean it, and you have to keep an eye out for it, especially if you're doing any sorts of aggregation and reports, like to be able to definitively say there were 100 widgets made on Milwaukee Avenue. You can't say that unless you know that there's no misspellings. It's a data cleaning thing. Yep.
Right, this presentation is obviously primarily oriented towards journalists, but I was wondering if you could quickly tell us what you think those of us who work in technology but would like to help the journalists, what would you say to us?
Do find motivated reporters and or editors and just pick a single project with a very narrowly defined domain and make it happen. And it's just a great feeling. When I worked at that Kansas newspaper, I went to the movie critic and said, wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your movie reviews and see all the ones where you give it 3 stars versus 4 stars? And he said, oh, yeah, I'd love that. So I said, well, all you need to do is put in your data in this nice little easy-to-use interface. And he was very excited. So motivate them by just honestly telling them what the benefit would be. And, yeah, I'd say start with a one-off project. Good luck. Yes?
I'm really interested in the decide which queries to run. It seems like the most flexible way to do things is to allow the user of a website to
That's true.
Choose their filters, dynamic query. But then that's not really journalism. For example, the Iraq death toll site, you have set queries that highlight interesting things. But that restricts the user. What's the best approach then?
There's also an advanced search there that I didn't show. But whether that's... You sort of offhandedly said, but that's not journalism. I might contest that, and just all of the effort that was done in gathering the information pushed it over the line somehow. But anyway, I agree with you, and I think that is probably the best thing to do is some sort of hybrid where you have that advanced search, but you also have clearly defined queries that hit the average person, that makes sense for the average person. Yes?
Can you just talk a bit about communities that build around these sites? If that's the case, and it looks like Chicago crime and the kind of deaths in Iraq, you would expect communities to start building around it. Can you just talk a bit about whether that's the case and how that happens and how that's then further exploited?
None of these sites that I've shown have had any sort of interactive features in terms of participatory, submit your own content or anything like that. So it's been limited, and the only way I really know is by feedback, emails, and calls. No, I never talk on the phone. Emails. So let's see. For Chicago Crime, I've gotten a ton of feedback about, you know, thank you for your site. I printed out a report and brought it to my local government official and asked him to install a brighter street light at this intersection. So there's the police beat meetings in Chicago. People now bring printouts of this site and, you know, talk about what happened. Let's see, the Congress site, a lot of people in government itself used it. Of course, I should have mentioned, this Congress site is nothing compared to They Work For You for the UK, which is amazing and was a definite inspiration. So I think if you haven't talked to those guys already, that's a definite thing to look at. They would have much better things to say than I. Is that it? Part two? Go ahead.
Just one thing. You talked about having sort of many different interfaces for all the different types of information. But if you've got something like talked about restaurants, reviews and information about that, and about bands, information about bands, and those kinds of information are often going to be tied quite tightly to the content describing them. So how would you sort of marry the fact of having different interfaces for putting the information and tying it into the content itself?
You can adjust the workflow so that as soon as the story is entered into the system, the next step is to enter the band information. Is that get at what you're asking? Okay. Anything else before part two? Okay. Very good. Finally, I wanted to give you a quick run through of my latest project, which is called Every Block. And the concept here stems from that Chicago crime site that I showed you. And my favorite part of this site was the block page. So every city
block, so between this street and this street, had its own distinct web page where you could see everything that happened on that range of addresses. And I thought that was a very powerful concept, getting that local. You can't get any more local without invading people's privacy. So I wanted to see if I could experiment with adding more information to that and also doing it for other cities. So essentially I wanted to make ChicagoCrime.org for more than just Chicago and more than just crime. And fortunately, I should mention the famed long tail graph. And this is very much a long tail project where traditionally local news, only the very important stuff gets covered. If it's crime, it would be a homicide or someone robbing a famous bank. If you're, people finding rats in a restaurant. All the sexy stuff, right? All the scary and sexy and newsworthy stuff. But if your local restaurant is inspected and actually passes the inspection, it's completely not newsworthy in the major newspaper sense, but it's still newsworthy if you live near it. And if you look at the long tail chart, of course, if you're familiar with the long tail cliche, there's actually more happening along the tail if you add up the whole area than there is in the high impact stuff. So there's huge opportunity there for doing a lot of good. And I was able to get a grant from the Knight Foundation for $1.1 million, which I think is about £1,000 these days, and over 2 years to make this site. And I'll give you a quick run through the site. It is address-specific news. So it's almost like a search engine in its simplicity. On the homepage, you would enter an address, and we'll do 121 North LaSalle for Chicago. And it shows you everything that's happened around there recently in a very straightforward reverse chronological timeline. Not unlike a Facebook news feed, if you're familiar with that, or any sort of blog where the latest is on the top. So you see your timeline and your map. Now, what do you see here? Three different types of things. First, public records. We deal with all sorts of government agencies and request any public records we can get that have to do with an address and are recent. So those are our two criteria. One is restaurant inspections. So any restaurant near you that's been inspected recently, you'll see on there. And you would see it on the list. It would look like this, and you click on it, give you the address, and then what violations they've found. So this particular one, no immersion basket, inadequate lighting, toilets not maintained, improper thawing, spoiled food. My favorite, unapproved shellfish. And you can click on any one of those and see all the other restaurant inspections that have that particular violation. So here is unapproved shellfish. Now this comes back to the philosophy of anything that can be linked should be linked. So the date is a link. I can click that and see any other inspection made on that day. I can click 34 violation points and see all the other places that had that bad of a score. And of course, click on all the inspection or the violations. So next we have crime. Because this is the successor to Chicago Crime, I aimed to do everything that site did. Other than the crime along a route, I haven't done that yet, unfortunately. But you have every crime near you. You have business licenses. So new businesses that have recently
obtain licenses. This is really interesting. It sounds just god-awful boring, but it's new business near you, and it's a great way to, one, obviously know about new businesses, but also just get a sense of what's happening in the neighborhood, because we archive everything. You can always look back and see what it was like last year. This one is business, or what a particular business license would look like. Building permits. This, another thing that sounds really boring, but it's super interesting if you live near it. This particular one is an antenna was installing a telecommunication connection on the roof. This answers the question, why does my neighbor have a gigantic cement truck in his driveway? And this is highly, highly interesting information, something that a newspaper would never cover. Graffiti cleanups and graffiti cleanup requests in New York City. Every time someone makes a request to clean up graffiti, because the city does that as a free service, we get that. So you get an idea of how much graffiti is being cleaned up, how much is being reported, how much is being reported but isn't actually being finished. This is zoning permit changes in San Francisco. Another real sleeper, right? It's like, who cares about that? But it's incredibly interesting. This is this particular address is requesting authorization to add a full bar to an existing full-service restaurant. So if you live there, you want to know, oh, that restaurant is about to have a bar. That's great news. This one is excavation permits. This is another... what the hell is this stuff? This one is anytime the road is torn up, they have to get a permit to do that. And we obtain every single permit and geocode them, put them on the map. And it is, in this case, we actually do the line of the entire length of where the road is being ripped up. So this, we get in advance, so we can tell you, well, you might not want to park your vehicle there because it's going to either fall into the big cave or be towed. And highly useful information. Filmings, another fun one for Chicago, because anytime that you want to film something, you need to get a permit. And we just ask the permit office for every single film location. So on your Every Block page, you'll see all your crime, your inspections, and if there was a filming near you, you'll find out about it. We have real estate listings, all the nearby property and how much it's gone for. I think Chicago's a little cheaper than London. And so that's public a couple of examples of public records. We also have fun from across the web, such as Yelp reviews. Yelp is this review website where people can review restaurants. And what we do is show you recent reviews posted like today about restaurants in your area. And the thinking there is that the news value is the fact that someone wrote a review near you is the news. So the restaurant might be 10 years old, but that's news in itself. We show you Flickr photos that have been geotagged near your address. This Flickr makes it very easy to grab all that information. And then the blobs, to come back to that, we go through, because journalists aren't structuring information and we're not working with the newspapers or for the newspapers, we have to automatically detect locations in news articles. So on your page, you will also see every news article in any of the major newspapers, the community weekly newspapers, a bunch of local blogs, anything that mentions an address or a location near you. So we're automatically finding those places. This is an example of robbers storm a hotel, stole thousands of dollars from a bunch of fashion show people right by our office, and we detected that it happened at 720 South Michigan Avenue. And what I want to point out here is that we're more sophisticated than just points. A lot of geographic applications always do a longitude, latitude. It happened at this point. It happened at this point. Well, it comes back to the theme of the real world being more complex than just either on or off, because we handle more than just points. For example, this article referred to something that happened in a neighborhood, and they didn't give the exact address, so we coded it to the entire neighborhood. It's not always a box. That particular neighborhood happens to be rectangular. This article mentioned a real whopper. The area on the west side between Ashland and Western Avenues from Lake Street on the north to Harrison Streets on the south. So very specific in the article, but we're outlining exactly what they're talking about. This is an example of us doing something and you're just like, who does this? You know, how obsessive compulsive are these people? But we geocode to that level. And then the third type of geographic information is, of course, a line, because sometimes things happen along a street or along some arbitrary bicycle route or wherever. This one, city hopes to upgrade a part of this street from Michigan Avenue between the Chicago River and this park. So on the map, you see the line. Now, we don't... Another reason for doing this, other than this being more accurate than just putting a point there, we want to make it so that if you live near the very southmost tip of that, you'll see it on your page as just as much as if you lived at the very top of that. And if we use just a dot in the center, the people, those outliers, wouldn't see it because this computer would only think that it was in that one place and it's too far to that tip. So that extra level of obsessive-compulsive attention to detail pays off. This one is an article about 51st Street between this street and this street is closed to traffic. So we pick that up, and that line, it applies to that line. We have for every individual city block email address or email alerts, and also RSS feeds where you can say, show me every crime near me and business reviews, but don't show me photos because I don't want to see the occasional porn photo. But show me all that stuff. And then recently we've added special reports. Now, I show you probably 15 of the different types of information that we publish, but they're all recurring pieces of information. So the crime happens every day, restaurant inspections happen every day. Sometimes we find data sets that are very interesting, and if you live near them, you really want to know, but they're just a one-time thing. And we just did our first one a couple days ago. This is in Chicago. There were some federal indictments of local government officials who were allegedly accepted bribes for some government work. And we scanned the official court documents for every address because the court documents said, at this particular donut shop, $500 were exchanged, and you know, so that the inspector wouldn't call out this violating building. So we databased all those and created this special report and pulled out the excerpt so you can see when it was. And if you had gone to every block that day or a couple days after that, you would have seen that show up in your feed. So we're aiming to do more of these sort of special reports. And that's an interesting step into being a little more of a newsy, editorial judgment-y organization. And that's what it looked like on your blog page. The following nearby locations were cited in this report. Alleged bribe. Now, how do we get all of this information? This is the big question that journalists especially want to know. One is that we're fortunate that a lot of the governments publish their own websites. Some are better than others, but this one, for example, is the Chicago Health Board Inspection Database. And we use those same techniques that I showed you with the Congress site, and we grab every inspection every day. This is probably accounts for 60% of all the data that we have. So it's the same thing. It's bringing together information from the world, the same thing that a journalist does, right? We're bringing all this together in one place so that it's convenient for people. But the other method is this guy, a guy named Dan O'Neill, who you can barely see. Sorry, it's a funny photo. But he is our people person, and he is constantly on the phone with governments and other data providers and trying to get them to give us their data. Now, this is a huge conceptual leap for a lot of government officials because they're used to these Freedom of Information Act requests where most governments in the states are required to, if you make a request, they have to give you the data. Really cool. But they're not used to ongoing FOIAs. They're used to a journalist coming to them and saying, I'm doing an investigation about homicides. Can you give me every homicide in January of this year? And then the government official takes a week and then delivers the report. Of course, we come to them and say, we're interested in not only homicides, not only January, but everything, every day, indefinitely. You know, so give us a feed. It's a lot more complicated because it involves, in most cases, computer programmers on their end setting things up, and they want money from us to pay for that, which we never pay for that because that's something they should be doing anyway. So this is a big conceptual leap for those. Now, I thought it would be best to end with what we lack, what we don't have on our site. We limit this to local news. And what that means is anything that affects either an address or an area as big but no bigger than a neighborhood. We don't do anything that's citywide. So, for example, Chicago is in the running for the 2016 Olympics. You won't find any information about that on our site because it affects the entire city, except if they're going to tear down your house to build a stadium, you'll find out about that because it affects one location. So that's it's not a downside, it's just that's our focus. And we assume that people get other news from other sources. There's also the fire hose effect. This is something that we're working on. Turns out there's a lot of stuff that happens around you in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, especially if you live in a dense neighborhood. So we want to try to figure out how to pull out the more relevant things, and we're looking at automated ways of doing that. I also want to do this concept of relative relevance, where if there's a pickpocketing 8 blocks away from you, you probably don't care about it, but if there's a homicide 8 blocks away from you, you do want to care about it. So right now it's just either everything within 8 blocks or nothing. So I want to do that. And community contributed news, we don't have any sort of community contributed stuff because I deliberately didn't do that because I didn't want to be labeled, pigeonholed as a user-generated content site. If we had launched with that, people just would have said, oh, it's a YouTube for your block or whatever, you know. Contribute news for your block. I wanted to underscore the point that there's so much stuff out there already that's interesting and that you care about. We're just doing the job of pulling it all together. And finally, sustainability is something that we have no idea about. We're funded by this grant and for about another year, and then we might try to get more funding. We might give up and say it was fun, we might magically start making money, which I highly doubt. But we're journalists, not business people. So that's the big question. And Q&A, I'm happy to answer any questions about this, if you have any. Yes? I'd be happy to do that. How can I get them to you? Okay. Okay. Back there.
Because you don't use citizen journalism, your site can't actually tell if it's true or not. You know, it says the world's going to be ripped off from here to here, but it doesn't tell you if that actually happened.
Well, presumably the government is accurate because they use those in dispatching their trucks. They use that same data. But yeah, you're right.
So and is there any way of patching in reality?
We don't.
Your layer
of right. We don't make any changes to the data when it is in an automated environment, because if we made a change, the next time it automatically updated, it would just override it. We didn't want to get into the complexity of keeping track of which ones we've manually tweaked and which ones aren't. So, yes?
How many people do you have?
We launched with 4, and we have 6 now.
And how many blocks do you manage to cover?
I don't even know how many there are in the... It's literally every block in the 3 cities. New York is clearly the biggest. I don't know. It's probably in the ballpark of hundreds of thousands. Yeah. It's all in just one big database. Yes?
I mean, in seeking all this information, making the phone calls that you said you're making, have you persuaded any local government or government organizations to actually put out more information? Have you found
yes.
feedback that actually generates more
interest? Yes. We have probably for 10 or so of our data types are pieces of information that have never seen the light of day on the internet. Maybe half of those have never been available to the public in any fashion, even if you physically went to the department. So we're very happy with that. And there will only be more, because our people person is just harassing them day in and day out. Yes?
Would you say that kind of schmoozing data is a full-time job? Because I'm here, it's even less available than it is in the States.
Let's see, some of his strategies, he attacks, poor word choice. He very kindly asks everyone in the organizational chain. So he starts at a top layer, maybe the director or the whatever the title is, superintendent, and most of the time, the answer to that is, he's too busy for you, he won't talk to you. Traditional, you know, government stuff. Then he goes down and he goes down to the level of, like, secretary. And then he works his way up. And by the time he gets back up, the superintendent or whoever it is says, just out of habit, well, you need to talk to this person first. And Dan says, actually, I have talked to him. I'm good friends with him. His favorite drink is Coke, you know, because he's just been getting to know everyone. And that really makes a difference. So, you know, it's more political than it is anything else. It's also knowing who's on their way up and who's on their way down politically. So this guy just got promoted. He came in from, you know, some other big city. That means he's got a lot of mojo and he's probably happy to talk to us. So it really is an art, and the guy that does it is absolutely brilliant and the perfect person for it. Anything else?
Right.
Sorry.
I was just wondering whether you've done any projects looking at archiving historical data or everything as a point in time going forward.
For some of our data sets, we've gotten everything since the mid-90s. We're happy to do that. I'd love to get more of it.
Okay, Adrian, that was absolutely fantastic. It's, I think that, you know, there's a session on Monday, which I hope some people here will also come to, or everybody here will come to, called How the Internet Changed My Journalism. I think that there's a few more thoughts on along those lines for all of us. I did like Debbie's aside when hearing that there might be a technician in the room. She went, write some code for us. I think right there is one of the issues we have to resolve, which is, you know, perhaps saying, I don't know, what are your ideas? But that was absolutely fantastic. I hope you'll all join me in thanking Adrian for it.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.